The City of Urbana, presenting the local farmers market at the square every Saturday morning starting at 7 a.m. with homegrown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods and food, and original works of art. Located in the southeast lot of Lincoln Square Mall, downtown Urbana. Information is available at 384-2444.
Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. Welcome back, I should say. It's the second hour of the program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal and Jason Croft is at the controls. Let me mention that tomorrow on the program, in the first hour, we'll be speaking with Dr. Linnea Smith. She's a physician, had formerly been practicing medicine in Wisconsin, but recently has been working in a jungle clinic in the Amazon. And she's written a book about her experiences entitled La Doctora, An American Doctor in the Amazon, and she'll be here in the area to talk with folks about her experiences and will talk with us in the first part of the show. Then in the second hour, the guest is Patrick Belgard Smith. He is a professor of Africology at University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and is one of the country's leading authorities on the Caribbean, and we'll be talking about Haiti. He also will be visiting the campus and will be with us in the studio tomorrow morning. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. In this hour of the program, we'll be talking about rural crime, and we have two guests with us in the studio. Ralph Weisheit is professor of criminal justice at Illinois State University in Normal and has written extensively on the subject of crime and law enforcement, particularly on the subject of rural crime. Also with us is Richard Goff. He is the public defender for DeWitt County, has been doing that for a number of years. And then you go back a little ways, he also was the state's attorney for DeWitt County. So he's argued both sides. He is also a graduate of Illinois State University. And I'm pleased to have both of them here on the program. And as we talk, of course, as always, questions are welcome. People are invited to call. And the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, thank you both very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Something just to start out with, I guess I'm interested in getting a kind of an overview of trends, particularly about how things maybe over the last decade or two have changed. As I think the perception is, you know, if you ask people, why would you want to live in a rural area, they'll say, well, they probably have a list of things, but chances are probably pretty good that public safety is going to be one of them. We have this perception that crime in urban areas is a much bigger problem, and that is probably true. However, it also seems that in more recent years, the differences between urban crime and rural crime are shrinking. And that, in fact, some of the numbers that I have seen suggest that overall in the United States, crime levels have indeed dropped, but that rural areas haven't actually enjoyed the same benefit, if you want to put it that way, that urban areas have. So can you talk a little bit just about that, about numbers and trends, just to start?
I don't think that's really true, that rural crime is increasing or that it has not dropped very much. Hmm. What you find is that it runs on a parallel path with urban crime. Urban crime goes up, rural crime grows up in the same way when it goes down. But rural crime is so much less frequent that if you're talking percentage change, it can't drop as much. You know, I'd give you an example. In Illinois, there are somewhere between 900 and 1,000 homicides in Illinois each year. If you take the 65 counties that the state police count as rural counties, there are only 44 homicides there. So two-thirds of the counties in the state account for only 44 of the nearly 1,000 homicides. So if you were to now have 50 homicides instead of 44, you'd have a substantial increase, even though you've only gone up six.
All right.
So percentage-wise, it would look like you've had a big jump. But if you increase the rest of the state by six, it would hardly show a blip in terms of percentage change.
Well, let me ask Richard Goff. Now, you've had an opportunity to watch these kinds of things for a number of years, both as public defender and then also as prosecutor. I mean, during the time that you've been involved in law as an attorney, have you seen things change? Are there anything notable that you would point to as a way of saying yes? Today, this is a way in which crime in the rural area is different than it was, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years ago.
Having only been practicing now for 17 years, I'm not going to go back to 20, but it seems to me to be remarkably stable. We'll have a run of, say, property crimes, or the machine shed thefts, burglaries, that'll happen. And then we'll have a run of drug delivery type crimes, where people are selling, drugs to their neighbors and their friends out there out in the country. A little bit of the methamphetamine came around a little while ago, but we haven't really seen that real big over in DeWitt County. Yeah. What we've seen is your standard everyday thing, the bad checks, the burglaries. It's all remains about constant.
Yeah. Well, let me pick up on the idea of drugs, simply because I think you might have the idea, because it's getting a lot of attention in the media, that somehow that there's been a very dramatic increase of activity involving illegal drugs, narcotics, particularly manufacture of methamphetamines in rural areas. Is that true?
Yes. Although I should say it's not true in every rural area, but certainly in farming communities and in pockets. What will happen is you'll have someone move into the area. I'm thinking of some particular counties in Illinois where someone was involved in drugs. They had moved away or perhaps had gone to prison. And while they were gone, they learned about making methamphetamine. And then they moved back to the area and suddenly had this skill that was very marketable, and they could teach other people who would then teach other people. And suddenly you have this meth explosion. Had that first person not moved back, you probably wouldn't have a huge meth problem there. Okay. And so happenstance is a fairly important factor, but we're seeing a lot of it. Meth has become such an issue that the spring edition of the Farm Bureau's newsletter had its cover story on methamphetamine. And certainly it wouldn't have gotten that kind of attention if it weren't a big issue for farmers and for the agriculture community.
Yeah. Well, certainly one reason it would be an issue is because one of the constituents is a farm chemical. So
absolutely.
It's out there and it's available, and it ties into another fact of rural life, is that you have a lot of land, you don't have all that many people. So it's maybe in some sense easier to commit crime because there are not as many people who are around to monitor what's going on.
That's partly true. The rural areas have a curious phenomenon. You have more physical privacy in the sense that you could stand out in your backyard and be naked and people probably wouldn't be around to see it. However, you have less social privacy in that people tend to know your business. They tend to know a lot about what's going on in families and in other places. And I should also point out, when I shouldn't have created the impression that there's not crime in rural areas, because there are two areas of crime where rates in rural areas are comparable to urban areas. One of those is drug use, and the other is domestic violence. Domestic violence is an enormous issue. And the other problem that plagues rural areas is DUI, because you got to drive to get places.
Yeah. Well, and just to pick up about the point about domestic violence, I guess that again goes back to this issue that one thing, one respect in which rural areas are very different than the city has to do with population density and the fact that in rural areas people may well be much more isolated, and so that's going to be a factor in something like that, I think, particularly in domestic violence.
Our domestic violence cases are all over the place. It's happening at the farmhouse. It's happening at the trailer park. It's happening in the apartments. It's just right down the street in someone's residential area. That's everywhere. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more, I think, attention paid to that problem than there has been in the past. And as a result, there's greater reporting. The aggressive nature of the support groups to get out to the victims. Speak to the victims, make them aware of the social or of the services that are available and the support that's available, I think encourages people to come in and report these sort of things more frequently. As a result, we see a lot more of it coming through the courthouse.
Mm-hmm. There are there got to be some respects in which a crime, say property crimes like theft, are going to maybe a little bit different in rural areas, that in the sense that in the city you're not going to have any cattle rustling because there are no cattle to rustle, or you know something that involves theft of farm chemicals or machinery theft or something like that, that it's just the object itself is going to be different because of the setting. But in terms of the crime itself, and in terms of burglary or theft, is there any real big difference between that and what you see in a city and then what you see in the countryside?
I don't think the crime itself is different, but I think the route to solving the crime is different. You're more likely to have people notice if someone strange is outside someone's house. You're more likely to have people recognize the person who was leaving the house as a member of the community. So that the idea that people know each other a little more and have closer connections makes an impact, makes a difference when you're talking about solving the crime and dealing with it. In an urban area, again, you don't have much physical privacy. Wherever you are, people see you, but they don't necessarily know you. They don't necessarily know anything about you. You're just another body out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, that I guess I can imagine, though, that might in an urban area, if the police are going around, they're trying to get some information about a crime, and they're asking people what they know and what they've seen, there is a certain level of anonymity. In a rural area where everybody knows everybody else, then that's gone. And I wonder, does that make people any less likely to want to talk to the police and provide them information?
I don't think that people are less likely to want to cooperate with the with law enforcement. What we see out in the country, as it were, was there's just fewer people to see what's going on. Mm-hmm. If they see what's going on, they're very quick to alert authorities or give someone a phone call and say, "Hey, we've got a suspicious vehicle sitting in this lane," or I don't know who this guy is walking up and down the alley back here, but there's more opportunity to do it, I think, because you can just flat out be unobserved if you're. I don't even want to talk about what different criminal people have thought about and what they've told me about, but. It's available. I mean, if people want to go out and steal, they can go out and steal. And we see it just all over the place. Catching them is not necessarily any easier. The pawn shops, thank God, that they're toeing the line like they are, because that's where we catch a lot of criminals is the pawn shops. They show up with those tools or with these stereos or whatever. And well, like Monster Pawn in Bloomington, they're great. They're really great.
Well, how do they, for example, if you're in a situation like that and say you're working there and someone brings something in, how do you know that it's not theirs, that they came by it by less than legal means?
I don't know how they do it. They have something worked out, but these folks at the pawn shop seem to be like have hardwired into the police stations because we've had a lot of people getting busted at the pawn shops. Huh. At least a lot of my clients, let's put it that way.
Yeah. Well, are they just as a legal point, if they accept goods that are stolen, is there some liability attached to that, or for them, as far as they're concerned, they're not responsible for determining where that thing came from. They just take it at face value when the person comes in.
Right, right. Well, you know, for theft, if you knowingly receive something that's stolen, or if you receive something under conditions that would lead a reasonable person to believe that it was stolen, then you're also guilty of theft. But in the situation of the pawn shop, no, they normally take product in, they pay out cash. It's all on videotape, and when the off law enforcement people come around checking, you know, have you taken in this or this or this, and they've got serial numbers, and it pops up. Yep, here's the transaction, and yeah, they go right to the tape and.
And there's the person who came in with the stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty straightforward. Yeah. Car stereos, things like that, that go straight from thief to end consumer, and bypass the pawn shops. Those things are real hard to chase down. You know, we have officers that spend days and days and days trying to track down people that are burglarizing vehicles and things like that, and then the people who are stealing from like one drug dealer stealing from another drug dealer. You know, that happens quite a bit, and that stuff doesn't get reported a whole lot. Mm-hmm. It just kind of rolls around, and they get them when they get them.
Do people people who are involved in criminal activity in a community, do they tend to be people from the community and not people from outside?
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
We were talking earlier before the show started about methamphetamine, and some of the work I've been doing this summer is in a county that has two counties that actually have tremendously high arrest rates for methamphetamine, but it's almost entirely local. These are local people producing for themselves and for other locals, not someone bringing it in from the outside. Not there just are no external connections to speak of.
And is that – is it also produced for local
– Yes.
Produced for local – it's local people producing it for local production.
There. Well, with methamphetamine, you actually have two routes. You can have it brought in from California, from the state of Washington, or from Mexico. And that does happen in some rural areas. But what happens in most cases is once people learn how to make it, it is so much cheaper and easier to make it yourself than to try to get it through a distributor that they begin making it themselves. And these are locals. If you're from an outside area, there's not much of an occasion for you to have a lot of contacts or a lot of reason to come into an area to start cooking. Mm-hmm. So the cooks tend to be local, and they tend to distribute to their buddies. The typical pattern is I'm going to make some, and if you want some, well, you can go steal the anhydrous I need, and your other buddy over here can steal the pills I need, and another one of your friends can steal the batteries I need, and then we'll share it. And that's so what you find is a lot of meth and drug stuff in these rural areas is bartering and not necessarily cash transactions as you might see in a larger city.
Hmm. Is the reason that this particular drug we have started to see more and more of it is that simply that it's not all that hard to make. If you know how, the stuff that you need is not that difficult to get. And actually doing it, I know it's potentially dangerous, but it apparently it's not that hard.
That's correct. It's not that hard. I'm told this. I never actually went and looked it up, but they tell me on the internet you can go get any kind of recipe and step-by-step instructions. Rock and roll. Go for it.
Hmm. And last count I heard, there was something on the order of 1,100 sites that had meth recipes. But the reality is not many of the people I've been exposed to have gotten their recipes from the web. They get them from friends. So they could get them from the web, but they tend not to. And they tend not to be rocket scientists. So I'm not sure how good a job they would do at following a written recipe. They tend to follow the visual directions of the buddy they're working with. But some of these people, when I say they're not rocket scientists, there was one case in Edgar County where someone had apparently tried to use a cordless drill to drill through a nurse tank of anhydrous, which, if you know anything about anhydrous, is just about the dumbest thing one could do. But again, they're not rocket scientists, and that in some ways makes it all the more frightening because they don't necessarily know what they're doing in terms of the chemistry of it all.
Yeah, and it is. As I said, it's dangerous. You're dealing with hazardous materials, and that's also why once you've located a meth lab and you decide that you have to clean that up, that poses a real serious problem for either whether it's law enforcement or your whatever kind of first responders, I guess, end up that being their job. They've got to deal with it. It is potentially dangerous, and you're dealing with hazardous materials.
Right.
You know, one other point that I think is really important, I don't think enough people out there appreciate the size of the drop in crime. We have in the state of Illinois, since 1991, about two-thirds as many serious crimes reported to the police, what we call felony kinds of offenses. So that's been an enormous drop, and perhaps Richard could address this, but that's been a drop within the context of more and more things being made serious crimes. So that things that might have been misdemeanors 20 years ago are now felonies. And so that drop is even greater than you might guess from just looking at the numbers.
That's true. I like to think that our legislature over in Springfield is doing just a wonderful job spending our money or stealing it, as the case may be. And if there's probably any increase in crime, it's probably white-collar crime that's been unprosecuted up to this point. But what we see as far as felony type crimes are the felony deceptive practice, forgery, burglary. Those are the main things we're seeing, property type crimes. Mm-hmm. Rarely our violent crime is way down. You know, someone getting beat down, I mean, to the point where they've suffered great bodily harm, as in an aggravated battery of that kind, is just almost off the table. We just don't get those attempt murders. I had a couple of them over in DeWitt County here, and they happened within like 10 days of each other, which was weird. But, you know, you don't get that very often. We had the incident at the lake here last year where the children died. That, you know, that's an anomaly. I mean, before that, the last murder that we'd had in DeWitt County, or it was charged as a murder, it was when I was state's attorney. And that was in 1990. So that's something that just doesn't happen out there where we are. People tend to treat each other pretty well as far as that goes. Now, they might cheat you on a check, or their neighbor's kid might come over into your garage and see if they can help himself to something, but violent crimes are way down. Forcible sexual cases are way down, which is thankfully way down. They're no fun to try.
Yeah. So how do you account for that? There must be some cluster of reasons.
It's actually quite an interesting sport to go to meetings of criminologists who have spent their careers explaining why crime was going up and the world was coming to an end. And what you find is a series of explanations that just don't make any real sense. There was a recent meeting where a person went through this long list. Well, we think it's because drug markets have settled down. And he goes down a whole list of things. And someone in the audience raised their hand and said, well, you know, all those things have happened in Canada, and we've not seen a change in crime the way you have. Mm-hmm. Basically, I have no idea, and no one seems to really know. It is possible that crime is like fashion, where you have cycles and trends and patterns that we simply can't explain very well. You know, I would point out another interesting little bit of trivia here regarding rural crime. My colleagues and I have spent a lot of time looking at rural crime patterns and urban crime patterns. And if you look at homicide, you look at violent crime and property crime, and you look at it at the county level, you can pretty much guess which counties are going to have high levels of crime by looking at characteristics of the county, renter-occupied housing, divorce rates, things of that sort, in cities. None of those things seem to help us much in predicting crime in rural counties. You can't tell whether a rural county is going to have a high crime rate or not by looking at those factors that seem to explain it in cities. And we've, quite frankly, been scratching our heads trying to understand why.
Hmm. Can you draw any kind of line between economic prosperity, that is how people are doing, whether people have money in their pockets, and crime rates? You would think that would certainly, particularly if you talk about things like bouncing checks and residential burglaries and things like, you know, those sorts of things, that there might be some relationship between that and just how well people are doing.
In DeWitt County, we've lost 200, 300 jobs, I suppose, in the last 3 years, 4 years, with Revere moving over to Indonesia and other things closing up. It's you know, it's been pretty rough economically for a lot of folks. But I haven't necessarily seen that they were the people committing any of these crimes. These were all working people that lost their jobs. The working people don't tend to be the kind that go out and do crimes. Our printers and our computers have gotten very good, and as a result, fake payroll checks and things of that nature, which are forgeries, tend to show up at different stores that cash payroll checks. But people I noticed that were doing that weren't people that were working anyhow. That was their job, was stealing. That's how they supported themselves. But I really didn't see a great, you know, all of us, we were scratching our heads. We're watching at the courthouse. Oh, my God, what's going to happen now? You know, all these jobs are leaving town. What happened was people left town, too, and they went where the work was. But we didn't see a huge increase in crime.
Well, what about that? What about out migration? And I guess I don't know what's been happening with population in rural areas, whether there has been any significant decrease in numbers. So you might say, well, maybe if there are fewer people, there's going to be less crime.
No, well, it's sort of a mixed picture. What you find is that there was a period up until the mid to late 90s where people were moving out of rural areas in substantial numbers. Now you're finding they're moving back. And they're moving back because of a whole host of reasons. Some of them can do their jobs by telephone and computer. Computer programmers, for example, don't have to be in a particular location. Also, there are a number of what we would call rural areas where people commute into larger communities. And that's becoming very appealing. And you can see that. I don't know if you want to call Mohammed a rural area, but you find more and more people moving out of places like Champaign-Urbana to 20, 30 miles away, sometimes even further. And so some of these rural areas are actually picking up populations if they're on the fringes. If they're really remote, then things can get kind of rough. But again, the economic link is a pretty weak one. I asked a police chief in West Virginia once. They were about to build a large facility. This was some years ago. The FBI was going to build a large facility to store records, and they were going to be employing lots of people in a very impoverished area. And I said, well, what do you think is going to happen to crime? And he said, oh, it's going to go up. And I said, why would it go up? He says, well, people will now have VCRs to steal. They will now have color televisions to steal. You know, we're poor here. We have nothing to steal. So ironically, with economic advances, you actually saw improvements in the numbers of crimes, if you want to use the word improvements. The other thing that does happen sometimes when you find rural areas growing rapidly, that the crime rate will grow faster than the population grows. And again, it kind of is counterintuitive in some ways, because you'd think with population growth, you'd have economic growth and things would get better. But in fact, crime and population density go together. The more people you have, the higher the rate of crime. It's not just that you have more crimes because there are more people. The actual crime per 100,000 goes up.
Well, we're about at our midpoint here, a little bit past. Let me introduce again our guests for this hour. The fellow you just heard speaking, this is Ralph Weisheit. He's professor of criminal justice at Illinois State University, and has written a lot about crime, criminal justice issues, law enforcement, particularly in rural areas, all of those things. And our other guest is Richard Goff. He is the public defender for DeWitt County and also has served as the state's attorney for DeWitt County. And we're talking about rural crime, and we have a caller here. We'd welcome others if you have questions. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The first caller is in Champaign. Line one, hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just tuned into the station, but have had several instances where people have broken in and stolen certain items, and inevitably they end up at the local pawn shops. And it's been a while since I checked the, you know, local or state ordinances on pawn shops, but it seemed to me that when I did last check it, it was something like if they just buy it outright, they don't necessarily have to keep a record or something with you know, their record keeping. But if they pawn it, then there's a holding period, and it seemed really contorted. And when I was researching this, and it was 5 or 8 or 10 years ago, it seemed that some reform could be made, especially with computers these days, where everything that's bought at the pawn shop would automatically go over to the police station and have some period of holding time, so that things that are stolen could be identified. And you know, it just seems like there's such a resource for the thieves to go sell things at the pawn shop, and I just for some reform of that, it would seem to be a real natural thing to just, you know, cut off that resource and you know, give people some disincentive to go and steal things, because they would have a harder time collecting on that.
Yeah, well, you know, earlier in the program, Richard Goff was talking about the fact that, at least from his experiences where he lives and works, the people who run the pawn shops are one of the law enforcement's greatest assets in recovering stolen property, because they seem to really keep an eye out for it. But I don't know. Maybe you can talk about what exactly the law says.
Yeah. Well,
but at the same time, they also really benefit from all of these goods that they can sell and make money on.
I'm not going to speak to, you know, their profit motive, but it would, I believe, if I am not absolutely mistaken, there's been changes, and they have to record and keep record of every transaction that goes through there. And also what I've learned is, it's, or at least from my observations in my county, the cases that I've dealt with, the individuals who are taking stolen property to the pawn shops are less sophisticated than perhaps others who are involved in property crime. They tend to be younger. They tend to be stupid. I'm just going to use that word because that's what I see. They're just flat out stupid. They go in there. There's a record made, and usually within a week or two or three, once the property's been reported stolen and the police have cast their net, as it were, they're caught. The more sophisticated of the thieves, and those that that have been in the business, I guess, if you want to call it that, a little longer, they tend to avoid the pawn shops because there is no record then of their transaction.
Yeah, I know that I ended up being the one that had to go find my stuff at all the pawn shops and tell the police, and I'm sure with as much stuff as is stolen, you could have a full-time job at the police station just keeping track of the records from the pawn shop.
Unfortunately, I think that's true.
Yeah, and I would think the general process where the police go to the pawn shop is probably more efficient than having the pawn shop send everything to the police, because what will happen is the police will simply be buried in these transactions and will end up not looking at any of them because they'll just be buried in paperwork. You know, the number of transactions that pawn shops do is pretty substantial. And certainly a good portion of them are legal and legitimate and don't cause any alarm or aren't a problem. And, you know, we really need to be careful with our police agencies that we don't overload them with stuff, because it's similar to some of the controversy now over DNA analysis, where you have, you know, something like 15,000 rape kits in New York City that have never been tested because they just don't have time. So gathering information is wonderful, but it's easy to overwhelm the department.
But I would think that if there was a database that could be shipped over even once a week, or, you know, if there was a holding period or a law that said they can't sell anything for 2 weeks once they take it in, and, you know, maybe it would be a local law or a state law or something like that, you know, you go on eBay and you punch up anything and you get a whole list of what you want to search for, and it's just right there. If somebody stole, you know, a TV, they could, you know, punch up 19-inch RCA TV and get a list of possibilities there, and it really wouldn't take that long once they know that somebody reported something stolen to see if it had been turned in the last 2 weeks. It's something that's gotten in my craw over the years and thought I would just throw it out there.
Yeah. Well, it's something you could certainly suggest it to your representative in the legislature. Because it sounds like that would be the kind of thing, if you were going to do that, it would make more sense for that to be an Illinois state law, so that there would be a uniform requirement, so that and everybody would know what it was and everybody would have to follow it.
Right. Okay.
All right. Thanks. Well, thanks for the call. But I guess just going back to what Richard was saying, is as far as you know, where you live and practice, the pawn shops are required to keep a record of everything. Of everything that comes in. And then does the person who is bringing that, do they have to somehow tell the person who they are, give them some identification, or is it just sort of the stuff that gets recorded?
As I recall, they're all identified, and they're all on videotape. There's literally a camera looking right at them from the moment they walk in the door, mm-hmm. All the way through the transaction. And they're signing papers, and they're given identification for everything that comes in. To be able to, you know, to send everything to the police, I suppose, would be wonderful if you had someone to deal with it, as Dr. Weissman was saying. But, you know, the way they're doing it now, as far as the police going out there and actually, you know, using a little shoe leather, it's much more focused and I think much more efficient that way. If you go, mm-hmm. if you walk in the store with a list of items and serial numbers, they can tell you right away if we've got it or not.
How many pawn shops are there in DeWitt County?
None. 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 Not one. It's a wonderful thing. But our people seem to be able to find their way to Decatur or Bloomington. It's only a 20-minute trip.
I see.
In either direction. So.
Okay. Let's talk with somebody in Indiana. Line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Two things. Where I'm from in Indiana, rural crime basically is growing marijuana and having, basically now, I guess, rolling mobile crack or meth labs, that seems to be pretty much a rural boys thing, from what I've seen. And the second question has to deal with this sort of general characteristics of being a public defender and a prosecutor. Not the same time, but I was wondering what sort of situations arise where I don't know if your integrity or whatever you might call it, it would be pushed one way or the other. If you can answer that, thanks a lot.
All right. Well, let me try to address this. When I first got out of law school, I worked as an assistant state's attorney and then as a state's attorney in DeWitt County. Then I got out of public office, went into private practice for a few years, and then became a public defender. There's really no crossing of the offices, as it were, as that goes. I hope that addressed your concern.
Well, I suppose in a sense, you know, or what Ralph was talking earlier about the fact that one of the things that maybe makes this whole business of law enforcement and crime in a rural area different from the city is that everybody knows everybody else. You know, they're small towns. And I'm sure that it's in local government it's the case. In law enforcement, it's the case. There aren't that many lawyers. There aren't that many police officers.
Right.
So everybody is going to know everybody else. And here in the case of somebody like you, you were the state's attorney and now you're the public defender. So
right.
the community of people is really small. So yeah. I don't know if that makes it easier to work together or if sometimes that makes it more difficult to work together. I suppose if somebody is in a position to exercise some influence, you know, I don't know if that, again, would make it easier to do something like that or whether it would make it harder to do something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Without getting into the old stereotypes and the old judges, and the old, you know, there's the old joke that a good lawyer knows the law, a great lawyer knows the judge. In DeWitt County, when I was the state's attorney, there was a fellow that was the public defender. Now he's the state's attorney and I'm the public defender. Just a role reversal. It is a small county. We have right now practicing in DeWitt County 6, well, counting the current state's attorney, 6 people who have held the office of DeWitt County State's Attorney. They're currently practicing law. We went through a period where it was one termer, and you go through a lot of lawyers that way, and we've only got about 15 lawyers in the Bar Association, so...
Yeah. And there is another angle to this, and that is that unlike a large city, in a smaller community, the police officer, the prosecutor, the defense attorney, all of these people have a much better chance of knowing the accused, of knowing the victims. Yeah. So you've got these personal connections. You know, a police officer in a small community, a judge in a small community, they're the judge and they're the police officer, whether they're on duty or not. And they may be approached in grocery stores. They may be approached when they try to go out to a movie or something. The idea of a public life and a private life as being completely separate gets blended together in these smaller communities.
Hmm. Yeah. How do, in terms of being either a defense attorney or a prosecutor or whatever, does the fact that the world in which you operate is small and everybody knows everybody else, and you even have instances here where you have people who have been both defense attorneys and argued for the prosecution. Does that make doing the job easier, harder? How does that affect the way trials are conducted?
I think I could say that trials are conducted with the utmost integrity. I mean, we're exceedingly careful to make sure that everybody's rights are being protected and zealously representing our client, whether we're the prosecutor or the defense attorney. I don't know that – well, because we know each other, I suppose allows – how do I say it? There's a lot of personal respect for each other as attorneys and as professionals because we do know what each other's tendencies are and we do know that – I know for a fact that this fellow over here is not going to lie to me about something, and I'm not going to lie to him. And for that reason, there's a lot of very good interaction. I don't have any problem going into another county and practicing there. It's the same thing, whether I know him or not. It's always the same. You know, you're not going to change from place to place simply because they know you. On the other hand, as you were saying, you might have someone approach you at the store or at the ball game or something like that and have a bit of information or have a concern that they pass along to you. That happens a lot. I tend not to go into a lot of social settings simply because of my current job as public defender, and I've been doing this since 96. You can't get away from it. I mean, it's, you know, if I want to go out and socialize, I usually go out of town or out of county completely where people don't know who I am so I can sit and visit and not be bombarded with, well, my cousin did this or you did that or, you know, I don't want to hear it. Thank you, but I'm off duty right now.
Going back to the question that the caller raised about drugs, we did talk a little bit earlier about the fact that something we certainly have seen more and more in rural areas is manufacture of methamphetamines, and that it was partly was because they were easy, partly because it's not that hard to get the stuff. And I think what Ralph Weisheit was talking about, the fact that it tends to be involve groups of people who sort of know one another, who know how to do it, and one person teaches somebody else and they teach somebody else, and that pretty much is it's produced for local consumption. It's a sort of local market. And I would assume that, as the caller says, that mostly what we're talking about here is young people, too. I mean, or is that true?
Well, actually, in the case of meth, it's a little different than some of the other drugs. You find a wider age range with meth than you find with other drugs. For drugs in the past, we were accustomed to, in rural areas, to them being primarily young people. Now you're finding meth users really cross the whole range of ages. It's not limited to younger people. And I'm talking about some people starting when they're 60. Because meth has another characteristic to keep in mind. It is something that some people get into originally not for recreational purposes, but to help them stay awake because they're working double shifts. Or sometimes women get into it to help them lose weight because it does suppress the appetite. And it bleeds over into an addiction from there. And so you can get people involved in it for all kinds of reasons, and it's the stereotype of a young male is not quite as true with meth as it is with other drugs.
I think you have done some writing about marijuana production in rural areas. Is that something that we continue to see?
It continues to happen. You hear less about it than you did before because now we have new emergencies to worry about, like methamphetamine. Mm-hmm. And what you'll hear from rural police now is, boy, it makes me long for the old days when I just worried about marijuana and I thought that was evil. Marijuana's still there. It just doesn't get the attention it once did because resources are now focused on things like methamphetamine.
Yeah. I guess the thing you think about is out in the middle of a cornfield somewhere, someone staking out a little plot and growing something in a place where generally you're not going to be able to see it. It's not maybe readily accessible unless you know where it is. And it's a way that you can do it and keep it hidden, sort of hidden in plain sight.
You can always tell the naive growers because they put it in the middle of a cornfield, which is fine until, say, October when the corn turns brown and the marijuana remains green, in which it's like a beacon, you know.
Yeah. And marijuana doesn't tend to explode into flame and burn houses down quite the way. Well, it immediately will explode into flame, but it's going to require some external source to get it there.
Yeah, it's not a hazardous material in
no,
and of
not
itself.
To handle, no.
Not to handle. Yeah. Let's talk with someone else here. Urbana Line 1.
Hi.
Hello.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I've been wondering about something for a long time. I'm hoping I can phrase it into a question that will make sense. About the methamphetamine, because you've been talking about that a lot. You know, there are legalized forms of meth that people use for medication. I'm sure you would know what I'm talking about. And I've always wondered, you know, what's the difference between the forms that people are making illegally? I mean, I know it's much more powerful. I mean, does it? What would be the reason for meth being illegal? I mean, as far as I know, it's not a hallucinogenic. Okay, so I'm just wondering. I'm hoping I'm making a question that makes sense for you here.
You know, meth is an interesting substance because most people don't realize it is legally manufactured under the name desoxin, and there are three legal uses for it. Believe it or not, we give methamphetamines to children,
right,
who are attention deficit.
Right.
We give it to those rare cases of narcolepsy where people have trouble staying awake. And we give it in unusual cases to people who are extremely obese as a weight loss tool. One of the curious things about meth is it is powerfully addictive, and the cravings last for a very long time. For people who are heavy users, it does appear, however, that when used in lower doses, it is not particularly destructive or addicting. And that's something that you don't find discussed very much in the research, and we don't really know very much about why that might be true. I might also point out that amphetamines, which are simply a slightly weaker version of methamphetamine, are periodically given by the military to help keep the troops awake.
Oh.
And you may remember the case where the trial was held in Springfield, the two pilots who mistakenly bombed the Canadians, and their defense was that they were given these go pills and they had to take them, and that they interfered with their ability to think properly and to make good judgments. So it is used in a number of settings for legal reasons. Why it is so powerfully addictive and destructive at high levels and not terribly addictive at lower levels, I don't know. I don't think anyone knows that.
Well, it is addictive at lower levels, just easier to, I mean, I've been prescribed it for the sleeping problems, you know, the inability to stay awake. But for example, I've stopped taking it a number of times because it also has side effects, and for example, if you have a cold, even the last thing you can do is take something that, you know, speeds you up. You can't do that, so you have to stop taking it. And it does have withdrawal effects, but I guess they're not, they can't be as anywhere near as bad as maybe the much more intense forms of it. So I've just always wondered about that, since it's legal in some situations. You know, I mean, it seems like it would end up taking, for example, you know, a fair amount of law enforcement time and energy to control these illegal labs, and I've just always wondered, you know, then why is it illegal in some situations and legal in other situations? And I guess it's still not an absolutely clear kind of thing.
Well, and the illegal labs have other problems. For example, one of the things used in making meth is lithium from lithium batteries.
Uh-huh.
And that is also a substance that psychiatrists give for people with manic, what we used to call manic depressive. It's now bipolar disorder.
Right.
But if you are not very careful about the levels of lithium that you're using when you cook your meth, the meth can start doing strange things to your mind.
Oh, I can understand why illegal labs would be bad.
Mm-hmm.
Just if it wasn't illegal, maybe there would still be illegal labs even if it wasn't illegal. Maybe that's where some of my logic falls apart. I don't know.
And those labs have – you're right. It's the labs that are part of the problem, and you also have the problem, of course, of toxic waste. You know, the old thing about every 1 pound of meth produces about 5 pounds of toxic materials.
Wow. Okay. I didn't know that either. Okay. Well, that answers some of my questions
then.
So thanks. It's been very interesting.
Thanks for the call. Just one thing I want to talk about a little bit here. We have a couple of minutes left, is law enforcement in rural areas and particular challenges that they face. And I, one of them, I'm sure, is the fact that rural law enforcement, their departments are small, and that they may have to cover a lot of area geographically. But again, because populations maybe are smaller in the rural areas, I guess I don't know if you would have a number like this, but I'm interested in per cap, you know, the relationship between number of police officers and populations, whether in fact it really is lower in rural areas, or given the fact that, you know, in cities, if you have a very, very large city, I would think that in fact that the ratio would be a lot, you know, of people to police officers would be a lot higher, actually.
It is lower in rural areas in general. Of course, you have exceptions, like Los Angeles has a very low number of officers per population. But also expenditures per officer are about half in rural areas what they are in larger cities. So, and it's not unusual to find rural police working without benefits, for example. It is unusual to find them unionized, for example. Almost every major city is unionized. And perhaps the worst part about the rural experience in policing is that certainly a survey we did several years ago found that 60% of the agencies in rural areas said that they routinely sent officers out to domestics as with one officer only. No major city would send would respond to a domestic with only one officer. It's a miracle if they respond with only one car. Yeah. But they would never just send one officer. But in a rural area, you often have no choice. You go by yourself or you don't go. And by the same token, backup can be far away. And that's a real problem for rural
So that
police.
Puts officers really in – particularly in – going into domestic situations is for police officers very dangerous.
The actual number of injuries to police and domestics is small because in most agencies, they go in with a good amount of force. They have at least two officers. Mm. But the potential for harm is serious, is great. And if you're going in with only one officer, that potential goes up dramatically.
Right,
yes.
Right. And I'm sure that it also just makes it that much more difficult to try to in a positive way to intervene in this situation.
Absolutely.
If there's only one.
How do you have one person keep two people apart? It's difficult. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
In my experience, the last police shooting that we had in DeWitt County was at a domestic, and it was an officer with almost a hostage situation. The fellow was sitting there holding a knife to his wife's throat, and when he made a move, the officer shot him. That was the last time, I believe, in DeWitt County that a policeman's fired their gun in anger, or in the line of duty, I should say.
What about the career of the police officer? I mean, and in terms of the number of years people are police officers, is there any big difference between rural and urban?
I think you're more likely to find an urban officer going to an agency and staying there. Rural police tend to move around a lot. They shift from one agency to another, in part because the pay is so bad, it's hard to live on what they're getting paid often. If they have any kind of aspirations, if you've got a three-person department, there's not much of a place to move up to. And so you do find a lot of moving around. If people stay, it's because it's their hometown and they don't want to leave it. But moving is very common.
Oh, yeah. They're looking to move up. You have those that are nesters. They come in and they're staying, and that's fine. But we have a lot of people that we lose to Champaign, that we lose to Decatur, that we lose to Bloomington.
Both because pay is better, and if you think someday you'd like to be the chief,
if you want to make more money.
Mostly it's that. It's just pretty much about money.
Yeah.
Well, and even things like there are a lot of rural agencies that can't even afford to train their officers to do the required training. So they look for people who've either paid for the training themselves or who worked at another agency previously.
Well, that and the big departments can make out like bandits by taking the guys that we've paid to send to PTI and get trained and get some experience. They don't have to do that when they hit the city. They can give them a bonus to sign.
Well, we're going to have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. I just have enough time to say thanks to our guests. Richard Goff, he's the public defender for DeWitt County.
Thanks for having me.
And Ralph Weisheit, he's professor of criminal justice, Illinois State University in Normal. Thank you both.
Thank you.
The show today made possible by grants from 10,000 Villages, Downtown Champaign, and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, offering ground and whole bean coffee purchased from farmers using internationally recognized fair trade standards. The show made possible by also Eastern Rugs, offering a wide selection of guaranteed hand-knotted Oriental and Persian rugs of every size and color combination from new